Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Claire Daverley about her contemporary novel, Talking at Night. Claire has been writing stories ever since she was 6 years old, and after graduating with a degree in fine art from Oxford, she began a career in publishing, writing about books by day, but penning her own by night. Claire now lives in Scotland with her husband and spaniel. In this episode, we discuss how the characters of her novel lived in her head for years before she found a way to put them on the page, why she made the contentious decision not to use speech marks, and why this novel was third time lucky in getting an agent. But before we hear that, here's Claire with an excerpt from Talking at Night.
Will realises there is something about Rosie Winters the night he meets her at the bonfire, when he tells her that his mother left. They are sitting beside each other, with the blaze lifting into the November darkness, part of a broken circle of sixth formers, fingerless gloves, beer cans, distant waves beyond the pines. He doesn't know Rosie, really, despite sharing a school and some friends, but tonight they are talking, a little. Small talk at first, insignificant, until his friend Josh, her twin brother, makes a comment about their parents, and Rosie laughs, barely audible, above the bonfire. And before he can think what he's doing, he's told her he doesn't know his own mother. It is something he's never said out loud before, navigated usually with a dip of the head, a passing of the moment. But he finds himself telling her, this girl with her split ends and untamed eyebrows and her pale, slender hands, that his mother walked out years back while he was watching cartoons before school. She looks at him when he says it, the flames held in her eyes. There isn't sympathy or curiosity in her face, no frown or twitching mouth, reactions he might have expected if he'd had time to think about it. Where do you think she is? She asks him after a moment. He pauses, looks at the sky patched through the gaps in the trees. The smoke from the fire curls upwards, and there are stars with one larger, whiter than the others. A planet, perhaps, or a moon. I don't know, he says to her. Anywhere. And Rosie Winters repeats the word back at him, like she's really thinking about it, like she's wondering what anywhere might look like.
Hi, Claire. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really happy to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, Talking at Night.
Hi, Chloe. Thank you so much for having me on. It's just such a delight to be here.
Thanks, Claire. Can you start by introducing your novel for us? Tell us what Talking at Night's all about.
Yeah, of course. So Talking at Night is my debut novel. It's contemporary fiction that tells the kind of long, winding love story between two people, Will and Rosie, who meet one night at a bonfire in their final year of school, only to form this instant connection. And that connection deepens as they get to know each other, over sort of late night conversations and secret texts and walks by the sea, only for an unexpected tragedy to occur that summer, which in turn shatters any chance they have for romance. But it's that tragedy that not only tears them apart, but draws them back to one another again and again over the next sort of 20 years that the novel spans. So it follows their lives separately and together, and is very much kind of a character study about these two people and their chemistry. So it's a book about love, but also mental health and grief and family dynamics. And I just really love novels that tread both light and dark, and I wanted to write something that sort of did the same.
Mm. Where did the novel begin then? What was your starting point? Was there kind of one moment where you sat down and thought, okay, I'm going to write this love story, or did it kind of start from somewhere else?
Yeah, it was definitely from somewhere else. It wasn't kind of a decisive moment. I can't remember a time when I kind of wasn't writing. I always had a story or, you know, a hopeful novel on the go, and I was always sort of scrawling things down and ideas and lines of dialogue in like notebooks or on my phone. And I can remember Will and Rosie just percolating, the sort of characters or these two voices, but years and years ago, we're probably talking 6 or 7 years ago, and I can't pinpoint the moment they kind of first came to me, but but I knew that I wanted to get to the heart of who they were. So I was just sort of working on other projects and just writing things down about them in the background for a long, long time. And then when it was time to sort of get their story down on paper, I wrote it, I suppose, in about 9 months with maybe 3 months of editing on top of that with my agent. So that sounds really quick, but in the grand scheme of things, I've probably been thinking about this book for about 6 or 7 years.
Mm. And was this your first attempt at a novel? Was this the first one you finished? Or had you had, you know, have you got some secret novels stashed away somewhere?
Yeah, this was third time lucky, for sure. Like, and that's in terms of when I was sort of taking it seriously, I suppose, mm. in air quotes. I'd written 2 full novels before this one, Third Time Lucky, got signed. So it, like I say, it had been years and years of sort of trying. I'd been writing ever since I was little and as a teenager, but then after I graduated university, I was submitting my sort of first novel to agents from them and just getting repeated rejections, as you know, is the way, and trying new things. And so it was, yeah, it was a long process. It certainly wasn't an overnight sort of hooray moment. It was a slow build, which nothing, you know, worth it, it ever comes easy. So I have a lot of kind of respect for those novels that are still in the drawer and not seen the light of day, because I probably wouldn't have written Talking at Night without them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What do you think then that was, what do you think was special about this book then that kind of captured your agent's attention, that made you kind of think, I mean, you were obviously taking it seriously anyway because you were trying to get an agent at this point, but what was special about this book? What did you think, do you think it had like a magic ingredient or a kind of special hook that kind of lured agents in? What do you think it was about this book?
It's such an interesting question, and it's so hard to say, else I feel like if there was sort of an equation or a something that would work, we'd all just go and do it again, yeah, sort of every time. So I think it was just an element of having failed and worked really hard on other projects that weren't quite making it. It was sort of learning the craft in a way. So learning how to write, how not to write. I became a much more ruthless editor. I think my first 2 books were certainly on the kind of longer side. And I was sort of finding my voice as a writer and what it was that I wanted to write about. So sort of Third Time Lucky, I was much stricter with myself in terms of kind of length and description and all of that kind of stuff, which I had to learn just over many years of trying, really. And I think as well, the failed books just sort of put me in agents' minds. So I did, the way I sort of landed my agent, which I know we might go on to talk about in more detail later, but was very much because she had read a previous novel and really liked it and sort of remembered me and just said, please get in touch if and when you write something else. So I think just putting yourself out there, even if it doesn't sort of work out the way you want initially, it was just trying and trying again. I'm not sure that it was, there wasn't sort of an ingredient that suddenly came to mind that Talking at Night had that the other books didn't. I think I learned a lot about writing over the sort of 10 years that I was trying.
Yeah, you were a better writer, although your agent or your now agent saying kind of come back to me with a different book is somehow reassuring and also slightly terrifying, because how do you know what your agent's going to like next? You know, that's just something that would go through my mind. And it's almost that it's so lovely. It's like when jobs say, you know, we really love you and we'll keep you in mind. And you're like, but what more do I have to do to impress you? And that's what it's like with agents a little bit, I think. But obviously you did find the magic, which
thank
is
you.
A great thing.
I do remember that conversation because it was the first time an agent had ever phoned me as well. So I'd had a lot of just email rejections, obviously. And she phoned me up and, you know, she really spent the time telling me what she'd liked about my previous novel. But she was, you know, she was very constructive and she sort of said, you can go away and work on this book and try and restructure it, or just get in touch with something down the road if you write something new. So I spent a long time soul searching about what the right thing to do was. And like you say, you don't want to end up writing something to please somebody else. I was very conscious that that would immediately take the joy and the sort of the interest for me as a writer out of the process. So in the end, I was like, I think it's time to write this story that's been percolating for a long time. And it was just the right time. You know, it's, I can't really tell you why I didn't sit and write Talking at Night 6 years back when I had the idea initially. It was kind of like I was working on other things at the time, and that was sort of more interesting, I suppose. And I am quite sort of, I like the magical thinking about all this stuff, that like the right idea will come at the right time, or it will make itself known when it's time to sit and write. That's probably my Elizabeth Gilbert fangirling going on right there.
So let's touch back on the book then. Tell us a little bit more about Rosie and Will. How did these characters, I mean, you said you had them in your head for many years. How
Yeah.
did they take shape then? How did they go from being that voice in your head to kind of forming on paper? One question I have, which I think is really important, and I've said this before on other episodes, that people tend to think that writing love stories is somehow easy, which I think is totally the opposite. How do you create these characters then to make us really want them to fall in love? How did you manage to do that? How did you do this trick, Claire? How did you create these characters that you're yearning for them to get together?
I mean, I wish I had some really like insightful advice, and I feel like I didn't really think about it as like a strategic sort of thing, which I know sounds really useless, but I think because I'd sat listening to them, as it were, like their dialogue and the things they might say and do for so long, they really just took shape on the page in a way that I felt I sort of had little control over. So I knew certain things about them when I started writing, and I knew that they were both going to be quite damaged individuals. So they both had sort of their own baggage in some way. I mean, who doesn't, I guess? But I had this sense of kind of their joint sorrow or difficulties that would link them in some way. So immediately I felt like they understood each other in a way that made it very easy to kind of believe in their connection, I suppose, on the page. And I think on the face of it, they're both from loving families in different ways. They have a lot of options open to them. They're supported, they're bright, they're interested in the world, and yet they both kind of carry this level of darkness or melancholy, which manifests in very different ways for the two of them. But it meant when I was writing them, I always sort of knew there was this level of empathy between the two of them. And that's why they fall in love. And that's why it was easy. I say easy. That's why it felt natural, that they were meant for one another. They see each other in a way that nobody else in the book does. So there's a huge sort of supporting cast of characters, I suppose. And they are close to these characters in different ways, but it's only Will and Rosie who truly see what's going on for the other. You know, for Rosie, she's this sort of smart, high-achieving, good girl. And then Will is this very aloof, very detached, very cool kind of motorcyclist who doesn't want to tick boxes in his life. And there's just a lot more to them than that, that anybody else sees. So that understanding between them just kind of happened while I was writing. And if the book ever lost its way, which, you know, it does when you're sitting on your own looking at the screen and wondering if whatever you're doing is even making any sense, I kind of always brought it back to the two of them in a room together on the page, because that's when everything sort of slotted into place. Yeah.
Do you think then, I mean, you said it kind of wasn't necessarily kind of conscious that you were building these connections between them. Do you think it's almost that over time you must have absorbed kind of favorite books or TV or film where they have a really strong love story, that you've kind of almost absorbed that sense of kind of almost not plot structure, but almost like you know the things that need to be in place to make a good love story. Do you think it's almost become part of your process just because you've just absorbed it from other things? So it kind of turned into your subconscious. I hope that makes sense to you what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really fair sort of observation. And like I literally grew up on like those fabulous romantic 80s, 90s movies, Dirty Dancing, Pretty Woman, all the Nora Ephron stuff. I inhaled all that when I was a kid. And then when I was in my 20s, I was much more kind of taken with the grittier sort of real life romances, like Fleabag or Scenes from a Marriage and all that kind of stuff. And in my head, there was like, surely there's somewhere in between in terms of the stories I want to write. Like, it doesn't have to be this sweeping Hollywood, happy ending love story, but at the same time, it doesn't have to be this sort of dark, gritty, really difficult journey that, and I felt like there was something in between. So I'm sure both those ends of the spectrum like fed into the love story that I ended up writing for sure.
And I guess it's another, I, if you want to call it a trope or a kind of common theme that we see in love stories. And it was something that struck me while I was reading your book, is that when you're writing a love story, you have to keep your characters apart, really, to make your story satisfying, because you want your readers to be like shaking the book, like, come on, get together. So were you conscious of thinking, right, okay, this has got to happen to keep them apart, and then this is going to happen? So were you thinking of kind of all these obstacles? Did that help you to kind of come up with more of a structure to the book? Because I know it covers a long period of time, so they'll have natural kind of events in their life that occur, like going to university and things. But were you thinking, because I guess it's tempting for you as a writer to just put them together because you want them to be together, right? So I guess that by page 200, you're thinking, I'd really love them to be together right now, but they can't be. So how did you think about kind of structure and stuff?
I think you're right in that that was probably the most strategic thinking I had to do, sort of as a storyteller, I guess, because it's not a story if they find love and all is well in the end, 10 pages in. And one of the best lessons I sort of learned, over the last 10 years with writing is that there has to be conflict. There has to be, like you say, obstacles. You have to put things in the way of your characters getting what they want. So I did have to think about the things that would keep them from an obvious happy ending, and keep it at bay. Like for, as I say, so I think the novel spans 18 years if we're getting technical, so nearly 2 decades. But I also wanted it to be realistic. So it's not an explosive novel with kind of major mic drop moments. Although, like you say, there are some really life-changing sort of big events and forks in the road for them as we go. So it was about keeping that balance, I think, of their lives and their love story moving forward in a way that felt satisfying and made sense, even if it wasn't going down the sort of happy route where they get together and everything's sort of tied in a bow. It was very much about them finding themselves as individuals. It wasn't just a journey where they were trying to be together, which I think really helped with the frustration level of keeping them apart. It was like, okay, they're still not together, and yet there's a reason why, and it hopefully made sense as to why. So yeah, it was a balance of frustration and realism and satisfaction, not only for the reader, but like for myself as a writer. And I was thinking constantly actually about how you achieve that. And it was all about that ebb and flow of pulling them back together, like I said earlier, putting them in a room together. How would I do that in a way that made sense? Why would they be torn apart again? Like, what would be a big enough deal for that to happen? So it was kind of playing with these believable, hopefully, situations that life can throw at you. And just having a bit of fun with it, really.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Are you a chronological writer? Do you sit and write every scene in order?
I do. So I definitely, like I was saying, I'm a bit of a bit of a kind of scrawler outside of official writing time. So I will have kind of notebooks and things filled with bits and pieces, which can come from anywhere. But when I'm sitting down at my desk, it's very much A to B, until I obviously get to the editing stage. And I think that came from the advice from my tutor at Faber, who just said, keep going, keep going, keep going, never go back.
Did you have Richard Skinner?
Yes.
Yeah. He was very much like, you will finish this by September. I was like, will I?
Love the faith he has. Yeah.
Yeah, I know, exactly. So obviously the novel starts when both Rosie and Will are teenagers. And I was wondering what appealed to you about writing kind of that messy, complicated, I guess this is the answer to the question really. What appealed to you about that kind of period of adolescence then?
I think I'm just like really drawn to how intense those feelings are when you're a teenager and, you know, feeling things maybe for the very first time and everything feels heightened and important and really exciting or deeply troubling. And it's something we all go through, you know, and they're real feelings too. It's not always just down to hormones or teen drama. There are things that we really all feel like in our bones that you can remember for years afterwards. And I'm also sort of really interested in that idea of just getting to know yourself and like finding out who you are. And that's a really ongoing process, I think, even into adulthood. But you're just beginning it when you're teenagers. And I really wanted to write about that change or that sort of arc in both Will and Rosie's lives, because they both know their values. In a way, they're both quite confident and non-conformists. They're not malleable or kind of susceptible to peer pressure in their teenage years, which is also quite unique about the two of them. But then as they kind of grow older, life doesn't quite bring them what they hope for as they move through their 20s and their early 30s. And I just found that kind of layered and intriguing. And again, bringing it back to realism, very kind of realistic, I think. And frankly, it was just so much fun to sort of go on that journey with them and to go back into that early nostalgia of being a teenager. And it gave a sense of sort of shape to that journey and how long that had to span. I didn't want to be writing beyond the years that I myself had been through, I suppose, purely from a kind of authentic point of view and trying to sound like I knew what I was talking about. So yeah, it's a nice creative challenge following them from teenager to early 30s.
I'm gonna have to ask you about a very controversial issue now. Well, you've done something, Claire, that might upset readers, that might not bother some readers, but it's a kind of, I guess, controversial topic. You've chosen to use no quotation marks. So can you talk us through why? I'm just going to put it out there now. I have absolutely no problem with no quotation marks. And I just think I don't get the problem if there isn't any, because it's pretty obvious when it's dialogue. But anyway, if the writer's done their job well, it's obvious it's dialogue, which you have done. So you don't need to worry. But why, Claire? What was your thinking behind it?
Yeah, no, thank you, Chloe, for saying that. It's actually... The speech mark thing is kind of so much more contentious than
it's like Marmite, isn't it? You know, people really have very strong opinions. And
yeah.
I don't get it. I don't see a problem. But anyway, that's me.
It's funny because I've had kind of old childhood friends and things sort of say to me, why on earth have you written it without speech marks? And people get very kind of agitated by it, which again is sort of, it's just so interesting to hear people's thoughts, because for me, it wasn't an active choice. It wasn't something that I sat down and thought, I'm going to be, you know, really kind of pretentious and write without speech marks. It really was just, I've always written that way since I was sort of a teenager. It doesn't seem particularly original or fresh to me. You know, so many modernist authors did it. So many books I love sort of do the same, and I could, you know, reel off so many. But I just think the absence of speech marks felt very normal. I appreciate it's not for everyone, but for me, the reason I think I write that way, or, you know, I certainly did in Talking at Night, was because it allows the scenes and the dialogue to feel much more intimate. The way we kind of think and speak in real life doesn't require pause or punctuation. You know, we're often speaking over each other or missing things, or we don't know who's going to speak you know, next in conversation. And I really love that link to real life when I'm reading a novel. I love kind of immersing myself as a reader in the story and not being kept at a remove, which obviously quotation marks does. And it sort of reminds you that you are reading a story. And also I think it just sets an intention about the sort of tone and journey of Will and Rosie's story. The fact that it is going to be messy and painful and complicated. And the way I use sort of language and grammar, I think reflects that as a bit of a signpost at the start of the novel. And it's also, in all fairness, probably just my arts background, because I've always just liked messing around with words and like playing words on the page. So lots of reasons why I did it, but it's, yeah, really fascinating to see people sort of questioning mm-hmm. my decision.
Does it, or did it make you think about maybe your next book and think, oh, I better not upset any more people, and I better stick some quotation marks in? Because I just am curious, really, because I've heard all sorts of complaints from readers where you know, people have said, I don't like present tense, I don't like first person, I don't like this. And I'm kind of like you in that I will just write what feels right. Mm-hmm. But I wonder whether some people may feel a bit like intimidated by people taking umbrage to the kind of the way they've chosen to write. But does it have any effect on you? Do you worry about that kind of thing?
I think I would if I read reviews, but I stay away from them, just because it's always been the sort of number one piece of writing advice from other writers. So I don't go near it. And I know just sort of anecdotally that people can get worried about that sort of thing. But bringing it back to sort of why you write, I think if you try to please others, you literally couldn't write anything, because you're always, it's about taste, and you're never going to create something that pleases everyone. So you might as well create something that you believe in and that feels right. So no, I just, you know, and who's to say a novel in the future might feel right with quotation marks. I don't really set myself any rules. There's sort of nothing that is like, this is the way that I write and will always write. I think everything is always changing, and, you know, our own sort of literary influences are changing, and there's always, like with the story, things ebb and flow. But I think feedback from readers, whilst, you know, wonderful and in so many ways can be really helpful, it can also be very distracting from the writing process, which is why I try not to, I don't seek it out. I don't actively seek it mm-hmm. out, just because you're right, those things can get in, can't they? And
yeah,
I find writing is very easily scared off as it is. So I try and keep the noise as minimal as I can.
Speaking of noise, though, you have had some very favourable comparisons to Sally Rooney. And I was wondering whether you've kind of let that panic you, or whether that's been just a lovely positive thing to hear.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because I know a lot of writers who say they don't like comparisons, like whether that's with regards to their own work or if they're giving kind of reviews for others because they think it's unfair to the authors being compared. And like, I really understand that. But personally, this has just felt like completely wonderful. And I'm really honoured to have been compared to, you know, a writer of such quality. And I am such a fan of Sally Rooney's work, and I will always read everything she writes. So it's only ever really been a joy to me and very flattering. But I think as well, comparisons just provide context. In my mind, like, nobody can write like anyone else, and why would you want to? So every single writer brings something new to the table, just the same way that any musician would, any chef, you know, any painter who's practicing in the same style or era. And I think comparisons are useful for readers and for editors when there's so many books out there to choose from, and they kind of provide a hint about, you know, what you might be delving into. So I try not to feel the pressure or the panic. I try and just take those sorts of comparisons very lightly and very gratefully. And I don't sort of place much weight onto them. I think all books are in conversation with each other. Everything we read or consume, whether that's film or novels or music or, you know, cultural cultural, what am I trying to say? Cultural references, anything, pop culture, there we go. There's room for all of it. And I feel like a lot of people get hung up in thinking comparisons about who's better or as good as. And actually, yeah, I just think the context is really useful.
I did an event very recently and someone asked a question and they said, I'm really nervous about writing like to an agent and having to compare my book to someone else's because I feel like I'm either being arrogant or, you know, I'm not that level. And I said to her, I was like, go big, you know, be bold with who you decide to choose as your comparisons, because you're not saying I am as brilliant as Sally Rooney. You're just saying, if you like Sally Rooney, you might like my work. You know, there's a kind of flavor to it. And I think, yeah, booksellers use it all the time. And friends that I have that work in the bookselling industry, they're, you know, they have customers that come in and go, look, I liked this and I like this. What should I read next? And it's so helpful. And I don't ever see it as when people worry about kind of having to compare their book to someone else's. I don't ever see it as a negative. I always see it as, it's like you said, it's so helpful for editors to kind of decide where to place things and how to pitch things. And obviously, I mean, what a great comparison to have with Sally Rooney, but it certainly doesn't diminish your work or mean that you think you're as great as her or anything like that. So I think that comparisons are super helpful rather than being a negative thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think it shows the sort of fragility, doesn't it, in the sort of writer's ego. You have to, it's this weird swing between having to believe in yourself and also being filled with doubt. And I can totally understand that it's like people are nervous of looking like they're putting themselves on a pedestal. And it's like, actually, it's just a useful kind of tool that the industry uses, like all across the board. So trying to remove yourself from the sort of egotism of it, I think, is really important, like you say.
So your writing routine has possibly changed a little bit from when you wrote Talking at Night, because I know you used to get up every morning and write before work. And I wondered what's changed for you now. And do you have to kind of be a bit, because I'm assuming you have like quite a tight deadline for your next book, so do you have to kind of sit there and say, right, I'm going to write 1,000 words today and I'm not going to leave this desk until I have done it? What's your kind of what's your routine, and how do you motivate yourself or even bribe yourself to keep going on those days where it's very difficult?
So firstly, with the kind of routine, I do still like to write very early in the morning, sort of before the day gets in. I like the privacy of that before anyone else is awake. But I would say the routine is much more variable now. I'm not sure it could even be called a routine any longer because it's sort of all over the place. But writing early is still my preference if I can. I don't sort of sit, I don't hit word counts or anything like that. I did that for a while for book two. But I found it became about hitting a number instead of actually sitting and thinking truly about the story or the sentences. So even though I sort of hit the word count day on day, I had to delete pretty much everything that I was producing. So I really just sort of get as much down in the sort of hour or however many hours that I give myself early in the morning, whether that's just a couple of lines some days or a couple of paragraphs, can be a couple of pages on a really good day. So if I'm working early, I might write for about an hour, and then my husband will get up for work and let the dog out of her crate, and she will literally bowl into the room, and that's like my signal to stop for a couple of hours. I tried writing 9 to 5 at my desk for a while, and I also found that was really sort of pressurizing in a way. I thought that it would be more freeing, but I think it just, perhaps out of habit, I write best in snatched time. I still like writing on public transport, in cafes. And then as for motivating myself, like you say, was bribing myself to get it done. I think it's like a mixture for me of two opposite ends of the scale. You've got like fear on one end and then love or joy on sort of the other, you know, the love and the joy for writing itself. And then the fear that one day I will wake up and not be able to write anymore and just being terrified of that possibility. So I just write every day, almost like keeping that muscle flexed and keeping that fear at bay. So those are kind of the two main things that keep me going. And lots of tea, obviously.
Yeah, I was going to say nothing, you know, like today I'm going to write this, and if I don't, I'm going to have to, you know, like, don't know, go to the gym for 2 hours or something like that. So you used to work in digital marketing for Penguin Random House. Mm-hmm. And I wondered whether that kind of gave you an idea more of the kind of, I guess, the commercial side of books, you know, the book world and the industry, and wondered whether it kind of made you or gave you an idea of what makes a book work, or what kind of works for a pitch. Did it help you, did it give you almost like better expectations of what you were going into, or did you still find it kind of quite an unusual experience?
So interestingly, it didn't really help me at all with the sort of hooks and that sort of side thing, because I did work in the sort of social media and email marketing side. I wasn't close to the publishing process at all. I didn't work for a publishing house. I worked in like the brand team. So I was only sort of talking about books that were finished products already out in the world, which was great because it meant I got to talk about books all day and then go home and, you know, try and write a book that I wanted to read. So I was sort of living and breathing stories, which was just amazing. But I knew very little about kind of the acquisition process and the publication process. I'd never worked with editors or anything like that. And I actually think on reflection, it was really helpful that I hadn't, because it allowed me to keep my work life and my writing life very separate. And ignorance is bliss in a way. I think had I have known how many hoops you have to jump through, it would have scared me off even more. You know, the self-doubt would have tripled, and it was already fairly prevalent. But what I think it did help with working in publishing, and this maybe sounds a bit cynical, and I don't mean it to sound that way, but I went into the publication process with kind of very low expectations. I know there are just never any guarantees. You know, I could see, and we see as readers, you don't have to work in publishing to see how many books literally are published, not only every year, but every month. And working sort of on the social media team, I could see that things would be released and given some love, and then it would be a new season and there'd be new campaigns. And working with books was such a privilege and like so exciting, but it was also a business at the end of the day. It is still a business. So I kind of knew that as a writer, it would be very easy to get bogged down in the sales and the chart positions and, you know, advances. And it really is just sort of noise, and it can be very dangerous. So I think I knew from the off, to protect myself as a writer, I couldn't put any value on that stuff. All we can do as writers, you know, is try and write the best book that we can, something we are proud of for ourselves almost, because then everything else is out of our hands. And that can be very stressful, but it can also be very freeing. And I, at the moment, I'm trying to trust in the latter. You just don't have to think about the rest of the noise.
So on that note, really, do you have any advice for anyone who's about to have a book published? So thinking of the 2024 debuts that are going to come out very soon, do you have any advice for them to kind of how to deal with, I guess, the whole industry and the feelings involved, not necessarily like, you know, the initial part of signing the contract, but how to deal with that moment in between your signing the contract and your book coming out?
Yeah, I think just trust it. Like, just trust the process, because that's what writing is. It isn't always just sitting down at your desk and producing words. It's like, it's so much more than that. It's the fearing and the failing, getting back up and trying again, whether that's just sending another cover letter or scrapping an entire novel and writing a new one, which, you know, is not easy, but sometimes it's the right thing to do. And just carrying on, because I guess what's the alternative? Is it just not writing? And if that is a happy alternative, then writing probably isn't for you, and you'll probably be a lot happier without it. But if you do have to kind of carry on, no matter the rejections and the self-doubt, then just know that like you're doing the right thing, and remember the joy of it wherever you can. You know, I think for me, whenever I got in a really dark, tricky period after a lot of rejections or having to begin again with another novel or whatever it was, I try and recapture like why I love doing it in the first place, like make space for why you love writing and just believe in that more than all the other stuff. And I'm sure it will get you where you want to be.
So finally, Claire, can you give us a little tease, a hint about what you're working on next?
Yeah, so I am writing another novel. It's the same genre, I guess. So contemporary fiction about relationships and people. I suppose that's my jam. So it's a book about three people, and they're at that point in their lives, sort of in their 30s, when we're meant to know what we want. You know, everyone's getting married, having kids, settling down. But what if you don't know how you feel about any of those things? And it's about it's told through the eyes of a 30-year-old protagonist who is hosting an engagement party with her partner, and then her best childhood friend turns up on her doorstep after she's not seen him for 13 years. And it's the fallout of that sort of inciting incident. So it's going slowly, but I'm sinking into it and finding my way.
Well, it sounds great. I love anything with a nice slow burn and a bit of pining, so I'm sure it'll be right up my street as well. Claire, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, thank you, Chloe. It's been so much fun.
That was Claire Daverley talking about her contemporary novel, Talking at Night, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it'd be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.